Okay, we have the questions. So here we go for the questions this evening. Here we go, the first one. Is it better to stay with attention on the breath only, or to move from the breath to the sensations in the body? I was taught the latter as the Goenka-led Vipassana course. Also, I'd be very grateful if you could talk us through some of the seated meditation sessions like you do on Friday evenings at Nolamara. The second question first. Sometimes that people like being guided, but sometimes people hate it. So what I would suggest, if you really like the guided meditations, get some from Nolamara, put it on your iPod, and you can listen to it sort of while everyone else is being quiet. Because what happens in Nolamara, if you give the guided meditation, that some people like it because it leads them along, but to other people it's too fast, some people too slow, and some people find it very disturbing. So that's why I don't usually do any guided meditations on a 9-day retreat, except maybe the very last of a metta meditation. But I really don't do that because sometimes that people have to go on their own pace, some people are going faster, some people are going slower. That's the trouble with the guided meditations. And when you say to stay attention on the breath or to move from the breath to the sensations in the body, it's probably best to actually to do the sensations on the breath or just keep it natural, because the sensations on the body is much coarser than the sensations on the breath. So actually by going back onto the breath, you're going backwards in meditation, not deeper. So the best thing for you to do is just to be, what I've been saying this morning or yesterday morning about just going in and keeping it natural. If the mind wants to stay with the breath, let it. But if now the mind feels that now it wants to, it's not ready for the breath yet, it will go back onto something coarser like the feelings in the body. So the best way of meditation is actually not directing things and saying, now I'm going to do this, now I'm going to do that. But just your whole job is to settle the mind down, keep it peaceful, keep it calm. And similarly, the very first day, remember the water, to try and keep the water still. So you've got to put it down. Your whole job is to see how that water can be totally still, how your mind can be settled. And you'll find that the way to get the mind settled is to not interfere with it, not sort of keep doing things, not keep changing, messing around, but just allow the mind to settle down, and the mind will settle down where it feels it needs to go. So the general way is, you know, you maybe start on the body, but then you go present moment, silence, watching the breathing, and then the full awareness of the breath, the beautiful breath, nimittas, jhanas, a natural course of events, rather than you deciding what to do. It's all going in. So you don't need to change your object, just go inside it. So really the breath is inside the body, not the body inside the breath. So if you go from the breath to the bodily sensations, you're actually going backwards. Is that okay? Okay. If you don't like the answer, write a question tomorrow. That was a bad answer, Ajahn Brahm. The last thing I ever want here is a group of sycophants who say, yes, Ajahn Brahm. And afterwards you say, that was a stupid thing he said. So if it doesn't make sense, say so. Just to add a thought to this morning's talk, oh my goodness, it's all about stopping thinking, not adding more thoughts. Well, I know what you mean, that's only a joke. To add a thought to this morning's talk, man will never invent a seat which will always be comfortable to the body, as the body is inherently dukkha. This body is dukkha arisen, dukkha rising. If man will never invent a seat which will always be comfortable. Do you think women can do it though? I don't know. It's true that no one would ever invent a seat which would always be comfortable, because it's true the body is always inherently dukkha, but some seats are more comfortable than others. So you try and find the most comfortable seat, but you will never find it perfectly comfortable. So what do you do when it's not quite comfortable? This is good enough. Once I was watching my breath and I felt aches in my leg, I decided not to stop but turn my attention to the aches to see how long I can stand and observe it. The aches got worse, then slowly subsided. Just when it was getting less painful, suddenly I thought, this is funny, ha ha ha, and I burst out laughing, quietly though. This reaction is very weird. I wonder whether Ajahn could explain. No, it's great. I like finding things funny. Because when you find things funny, you're not getting into anger or ill will. Laughter is one of the great ways of overcoming negativity. So you can have an argument with someone and somebody cracks a joke and you both laugh and it's the end of the argument. So laughter is very good. So you were having a nice little time there. Aches in my leg. Did not stop but turned attention to the aches to see how long I could stand it and observe it. And the aches got worse and slowly they subsided. And just when it's getting less painful, you suddenly thought, this is so funny. So keep on laughing. I think it's very, very good. You know, when a person gets fully enlightened, what's the person who's fully enlightened called? A ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-rahat. Okay, I was pushing it a bit, but never mind. It's a good joke. Ajahn, is it absolutely necessary to have the jhanas to gain insights? People always like the shortcuts. So they say, please, can there be another way except the jhanas? And I like telling the story because there's a couple of people here who know this story because I think it was their brother. Actually, I think one of the people was actually here. Was he in the same car as me? I can't remember. No, his brother was driving. Because I was giving a talk in Kandy, in Sri Lanka. And after finishing the talk, the driver took me back and went along the usual road to Colombo. Yeah, you weren't the driver, Sheila, but you know all the people involved. Because she went on ahead. And she went the normal road, the straight road, which goes straight back from Kandy to Colombo. As for my drive, we decided to take the shortcut. And we ended up, I think, just north of Kalutara, we got back to the place about 2 or 3 hours after, was it 2 hours or 3 hours? After, 2 or 3 hours after everybody else. Why? Because we took the shortcut. That was right, starting, wasn't it? You know, were you in the car? You were, you see. That's what happens when you take the shortcut. You always end up wasting time. So, no shortcuts. The Buddha was the most compassionate and wise being ever. And that's why he said, look, if you want to get enlightened, Eightfold Path. You know, the Eightfold Path. And the Buddha was so kind. Now, if there was a sevenfold path, you know, we did knock one off, you know, just to make it easier for you, you know, and you have a sevenfold path. You know, you don't have to sort of keep right speech or something. You know, you can mouth off to your husband or anybody. But no, an eightfold path, which means that's the minimum. And we all know the number eight of the eightfold path is jhanas. You can't get around that. So, yeah, I'm afraid it's jhana or nothing. Actually, jhana is nothing, so I really shouldn't say that, but you know what I mean. It's, if you want to get enlightened, do it properly. Ajahn, please clarify the sutra about the elephant trainer and how it relates to meditation. How it puts on the harness and at first not comfortable, then comfortable. Is it like restraint takes getting used to? Please clarify. Thank you for meditating with us in the hall. It's inspiring. Yeah, I mean, the idea, the Buddha used the simile of an elephant because his monks were like elephants. And you know, some of you like elephants, you know, just very hard to train, big and stubborn. But what happens, you put sort of, you know, people sitting down. At first, when you first get here, it's hard to sort of get used to the cushion. And so that's why the first few days, you know, I've learned from the time of the elephant trainers in those days, these days psychology in 2,500 years has worked much, much better. So we have new tricks to train elephants these days. So we don't use, in those days, he used to use what was like a hook. And if the elephant misbehaved, it got tortured. Now, that might have been an effective method, but, you know, there's groups like Amnesty International, they won't let me do that anymore. So we don't use the torture. We use the other positive psychology by encouraging people. So it's true that when you first sit, you know, it's uncomfortable. Especially for those people who are meditating for the first time. You know, what are we doing this for? It's just so boring, you know, just sitting all day, nothing to do, can't watch the TV. So I can't sort of, you know, SMS my friends. Can't even talk to each other. Gee, that's a tough. So things like noble silence, and I hope you're all keeping noble silence. If someone's put their finger up to you 3 times, then please let me know and I'll get the masking tape out. So, keep it quiet. And noble silence is difficult at first. When you first do it, you think it's like the elephant getting the sort of the yoke on it. So he doesn't like it. But you know, after 2 or 3 days, this noble silence is wonderful. You wonder, why can't we live like this at home or in the office and keep noble silence at work? Wouldn't that be wonderful? And you speak when you really have to. So at first it's uncomfortable, but you soon get used to it. Same as being in the present moment and not sort of thinking about the past or the future. You just want to go, why am I doing this? You know, is it some law? I know that sometimes people, just because they're rebellious, Ajahn Brahm says, I'm not supposed to think about the past or the future. I'm going to think about the past, you know, just to spite him. People sometimes like they're rebellious. But now after a while you get used to it. And it's actually quite nice being in the present moment. So watching the breath, you know, again, many of you, when you first start meditation, it's a typical thing to watch. But after a while you get so used to it. And I've been doing this meditation almost 40 years now. Yeah, 40 years I've been meditating. So my breath is like a really good old friend. So me and my breath, we love hanging out together. So because of that, you know, I'm really used to that breath. So just like the elephant, it's used to the people sitting on top of it, and it actually quite likes it. So, you know, when the elephant gets trained, he actually gets a lot of joy out of doing these things. So it does get a lot of getting used to, but the elephant trainer, you know, that's you. Don't use, you know, the goad, the spike. You know, just use patience and use kindness. So yeah, an elephant can be trained, but I don't really agree with the way elephants were trained in those days. It's much better with kindness. Well, somebody told me this story, that this was actually over in Nolamara. And city centre there, was this occasion, I think we were doing one of our food fairs. You know, we raised money for, you know, this place before, the next food fair is going to be for the Nuns Monastery, for a hall there they want to build. They haven't got a hall there at all yet. But anyway, on this one, somebody got a camel. And we're doing camel rides around the park. And apparently, they mentioned this story, but this was a camel ride at a school fete, that's right. It was a camel ride at a school fete. They're raising money for their school. And this man, sort of, he arrived late. And, you know, there was a hot day and they were finished. But the man came and said, look, you know, I've always wanted to ride a camel, you know, and I want to also donate to the school. You know, sort of, you know, can I just do one more ride? And the guy said, oh, you know, it's okay, it's charity, you know, the camel ride might, okay. And then sort of the guy said, okay, camel, get down, and the camel wouldn't move, it was tired. And so the owner came up to it and started stroking it. Camel, look, I know you've worked really hard all day, and you've raised so much money for, you know, the school, you've done an amazing amount of good work. Now this gentleman has come from a long way, and he only wants to sort of ride you once, and he's giving a nice donation for the school. Would you mind getting down? Straight down, come on. Even animals know kind words, and just a bit of kindness. So that's a way to train a camel. That's a way to train an elephant as well. And that's a way to train yourself. If you use the goad or the whip or whatever, you know, you say in the morning, if I don't get up tomorrow morning at 4 o'clock, you know, what will you do? Give yourself a penance. Say, you know, just, I will have just one banana and no toast. Or, you know, I won't put any marmalade or jam on my toast, I just have it plain without even butter as a punishment for sleeping in again. Now, some people do that to themselves, and that just is really off. That's not compassion and kind at all, and it also doesn't work. Instead, like, reward yourself. You know, if you really do get up early, then actually give yourself double toast. You know, twice as much, you know, an inch thick of jam rather than... Well, I don't know, but reward yourself. Because it's actually much more fun that way, and that's actually the way you train. That's the best way to train an elephant. With kindness. Like, works on the camels, it works on everybody. Dear Ajahn Brahm, the man who offered 100 baht has left a legacy of opportunity for a wise and powerful teaching. That's true, yeah. Because, I mean, all of these things, we learn from life, and now you can quote from suttas, and I can give a talk. The Eightfold Path is Sammaditti Sammasankappa, and explain it all. And you can explain what the Buddha said, or read out a sutta. You can do that yourself. It's actually getting examples from real life know, from your life and things which you can understand, like the camel and just being kind to it, and applying that to Dhamma. And that's actually where you get the real good stories. So that 100 bahts, you know, a man who wanted to offer me goods to the worth of 100 baht, you know, he taught me about craving. And just, you know, how when you have a little bit, it's never enough. And so it's the same, your meditation. It's never good enough, isn't it? You know, you sort of get the breath. And it says, you know, you're having one, it's the best meditation you've ever had already so far in this retreat. I want more. Now that's our problem. It's the wanting, 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 and never being satisfied. That's why good enough, content, this is good enough for me. That's the way to go on this retreat. So you know, was it? He did give me a great opportunity. So did that man who lost his finger. You know, it cost him a short finger, but you know, he survived. You know, after a little while, he was back to normal again. But it's a wonderful little simile he gave. So all these things which happen in life, they're always wonderful learning experiences. What is best to do at the moment when one realizes one has been away with the storyline of thoughts? Acknowledge, forgive, let go, or learn. Yeah, you've been off in thoughts, in fantasy land. Don't sort of punish yourself. Yeah, I have. Okay. None of my business. Just let go and just be in the moment. It's a wonderful thing when you don't carry the past. You're not a prisoner of the past. You may have a totally restless mind. For half an hour, thinking about all sorts of stupid things, you realize it, you can stop, and you can get into a deep meditation almost immediately, just by acknowledging and letting go of the past. It's a wonderful trick to be able to do, a skill. Doesn't matter what has happened, you can let it go immediately. And one of the ways of doing that is to realize it can be done, and it's allowable, it's permissible. That's the biggest understanding. You are allowed, you're permitted to completely let go of the past. All of it. You don't have to keep thinking about it and carrying it. You're free. And actually, once that gets into your head, after a while, can I? Yeah. Really? Yeah. Okay. And you're totally free of the past, so you can live in the moment. So, yeah, you plan a little bit for the future. Live in the moment, but the past, you just let it all go. That's why, you know, people give me photographs of this trip and that trip, and usually I accept them, I burn them usually. Just get rid of them, because you know, I love to let go. What do you keep photos and photo albums for? Just lingering on the past. So that's what I would do when there's been a storyline. You just stopped. Finished, no problem. But don't carry around and don't think, oh, I shouldn't have been doing that. Why did I do this? I always do this. This is terrible. That's just living in the past. Finished, done with, gone. Especially if it's been bad memories. Do you keep bad memories? What do you do when you go to the toilet? Do you keep it in the bowl? Flush it. It's gone. That's what you should do with all your bad memories. You know, find that sort of the chain inside your mind. Flash, and it's all gone. When in meditation I felt so still, it's like I am jellied in my mould. I could hear sound noise, but they don't bother me. I enjoy staying still this way until some loud sound noise loosens me out of my mould stillness. Is this a way to describe stillness? Yeah, that's pretty good. And even later on, even the loud sounds just won't take you out. But it's perceptive, whoever wrote that question, they're doing something to get some ideas, and they're good ideas. The Buddha actually said that the last of the senses to turn off is sound. Now the body is difficult enough to let go of, but sound is the last one. That's why they say that sound can actually even penetrate. That's what gets you out of the first jhana sometimes. It's the same way when you're asleep. How do you wake up? No, it's the sound of your alarm. Sometimes even shaking you is not good enough, but shouting in your ear, you know, it's breakfast! You know, you hear that because sound penetrates deeply. So, you know, of all the difficult things to settle down, it's sound. So please, you know, especially now we've passed the first couple of days of the retreat, the settling in, please try and be silent. You know, when you're sitting up, try not to bang things or make noises. When you're opening and closing the door, especially in your cottages, try and do it quietly, so you're not disturbing other people. So the sounds, won't take them out. But imagine what the calm is like. Someone just about to get into jhana, and that's you. Ooh, that's really bad calm. So be very sensitive sometimes. In later retreats, people do get very sensitive to sound. So, that's why we keep noble silence. It's amazing, if you hear a sound like a door bangs, it disturbs you, but not as much as if people are talking. Because you always think, what are they talking about? So talking is one of the biggest hindrances, so don't talk. Ajahn Pom, last November retreat you said you might teach how to sweep the body in meditation. I would be interested to learn this and to know when to use it. But you didn't! Future's uncertain. Sometimes I say these things, but they come out of mind. Okay, we'll do that tomorrow morning. Do a body sweeping. Is that a good idea? Everyone's silent. I'll teach this tomorrow morning, just in quick. So it's nice and easy, interesting thing to do tomorrow morning. Here we go. Ajahn Pom, I was told, and definitely not by you, that the fourth Satipatthana leads one to Samadhi, which is the end point of the Satipatthana. This is what the phrase Ekayana Mago means in the Satipatthana Sutta. Ekayana Mago means a path which leads in one direction only. How can this be? At the beginning of the Satipatthana Sutta, the following phrase is used. Vinaye Loke Abhijato Manasang, which is Venerable Sir, you have translated this phrase as having abandoned the five hindrances. Therefore, according to my humble understanding, the meditator has already reached a high level of samadhi as he has already abandoned the five hindrances before he begins on any of the four Satipatthanas. As such, Ekayana Mago in the Satipatthana Sutta refers to the leading into the path of enlightenment, which is its end point. Correct me if I'm wrong. I've often actually taught that it's almost like two Satipatthanas meant here, and that the first is the mindfulness which leads you into samadhi. And obviously that type of Satipatthana, the five hindrances have not yet been totally overcome. So it's almost the case that that Satipatthana of being aware of the body, being aware of feelings, being aware of the mind, that type of Satipatthana is described in Anapanasati Sutta. Because there the Buddha said in the stages of Anapanasati, that's where, this is Anapanasati, the first step is being aware of the long in-breaths, long out-breaths, the next stage short in-breaths, short out-breaths, the next, the whole body of breath, which means from the beginning of an in-breath to the end of an in-breath, beginning of an out-breath to the end of the out-breath, calming the breath, that bodily sensation. And in the Anapanasati Sutta, the Buddha said that that's like the first Satipatthana, because you're aware of the body. But it is true, the five hindrances have not been properly overcome yet. And again, after that, you get to the delightful breath. This is when the breath is just so lovely, and that's when you have the fifth and sixth stages of the Anapanasati, breathing in, breathing out, you're experiencing joy, breathing in, breathing out, you experience happiness. It's beautiful, joyful breath. And then you calm down that function. That's the, seventh stage is experiencing the whole citta sankhara and calming down that sankhara. So you feel a whole breath, a beautiful breath, and you calm it down. That's when the breath starts to disappear. And all those is about feelings. And the Buddha said, the feeling, the joy, the delight of this breath, the wonder of it, that second Satipatthana, it's the mindfulness of feelings. And then you go on to the ninth stage of Anapanasati, where you experience the citta. And I've said that's the nimitta stage. And then you sort of, you brighten up that limiter, make sure it's really brilliant, and then you sort of stabilize the limiter, which means you keep it still. That's samadhan, that's samadhiing the jitta, this beautiful light, so it's still, it's brilliant, and then you release it, and that's going into the jhanas. And the Buddha said that's called mindfulness of mind, of jitta, because as I said, the nimitta is the reflection of your jitta, that's where you can actually see it for the first time. And that becomes the third satipatthana. Obviously this leads you into jhanas. And the fourth satipatthana, when you come out afterwards, you can contemplate the Dhamma, such as anicca, nissaga, and viraga and nirodha. So these are the way, especially the first 12 parts of Anapanasati. You're not in jhanas yet, it leads to jhana, and that's what the Buddha said, the satipatthana can be looked at. So that's what I call like the first type of satipatthana, leading you into the jhanas. But it's true, the five hindrances haven't been totally abandoned yet. But the second type of satipatthana, this is really what I think the Satipatthana Sutra is talking about, because, you know, he said in the very end of this, and the person who asked the question would know this, anyone who practices this way for 7 days will either be a non-returner or fully enlightened. And I remember the first time I picked up the Satipatthana Sutra to read it was I was still a student at Cambridge. And I remember the introduction written by, I think, Bhikkhu Soma. And he said that he decided, you know, he studied enough and really wanted to get enlightened, so he travelled to Burma, and he'd been doing this method for 2 weeks. He still wasn't enlightened. So he thought he might as well translate it from Pali into English instead. He was quite disappointed that, you know, the 7 days thing said by the Buddha wasn't working. And it's true, many people do Satipatthana retreats for, you know, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, and they've done it many times, they're still not enlightened. Why? It's because you haven't done it the right way. The Satipatthana which leads to enlightenment, you have to have abandoned the five hindrances. In other words, got into jhanas. And then afterwards, it's not just in the way. You've got the Satipatthana which goes into jhanas and the Satipatthana which you do on the way out. Because that's with the five hindrances totally absent. Then you can understand what body is. And again, you've got the data, the body was absent in the jhanas, totally absent, like the sim, the tadpole and the frog. Now you can understand what the body is. And feeling, especially the feeling which is of the five senses, which is all of your sensory, five sense feeling, which ties you to this realm of human beings. When those five vedanas, feelings, so the feelings associated with the five senses disappear, you know exactly what they are. So you can understand these things because of their absence. And the same, the mind. You know, the third satipatthana, yeah, sure, when you're on the way into jhanas with these nimittas, you've got face to face with this mind. But nothing like the mind released in the jhanas. You really find out what it is. Especially, as I'll probably mention in more detail later on, in the second jhana, this part of your mind is totally absent, the will. And you can't understand that unless you've had that experience, and that really tells you that you never decided to come here. You had no choice. Sitting in the seat you're in right now, you think you freely chose to sit in that seat and not another one. Nope. Total process, totally conditioned, you had no choice. The choice did not come from you. Now that's weird. And that doesn't make any sense to you. But you get into these jhanas, you know exactly what I'm talking about. So this is actually, you see, the mind, the jitta. That's why if you want to get enlightened, it's a satipatthana after jhanas, leads to enlightenment. If you do that for 7 days, if you get into jhanas regularly, 7 days, without any hindrances, then true, you'll be non-returner or an arahant. That's what the Buddha was meaning. That's why I really stress the jhanas. Does that make sense? Okay? If it don't make sense, please ask another question tomorrow night. Ajahn Brahm, that never makes sense. You skip the answer, you weren't really answering the question. It's important to really, you know, if I answer, which I really try to answer the question, but sometimes, you know, if I don't get the question, and then please answer it again, because personally I felt, you know, sometimes that's happened to me when I was a young monk, you asked a question and the teacher didn't answer it. They answered another question, and sometimes I thought that's very disrespectful of the questioner. So, out of respect for the question, if I haven't answered it, I apologize. Please answer it again, I'm trying my best. If repeating a simple mantra such as Om Mani Padme Hum in one's head is useful for if one is experiencing a continued runaway busy mind, or is this just interfering, getting in the way and trying to force things? Thank you. It's because you're already interfering, that's the reason why you've got a busy mind. Sometimes, you know, it's almost like fighting fire with fire. Sometimes when we have bushfires in this part of the world, sometimes you do sort of back burning. In other words, there's a fire coming up to the road, you start at the road and you burn back there to create a fire break. So sometimes it is okay to do a little mantra, you know, if you're sort of really going a bit crazy. And Om Mani Padme Hum might work. You know, in Thailand, as many of the people from Thailand here, you know the mantra they use, Buddho, breathing in, Buddho, breathing out, Tho, Buddho, 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 along with the breath. But if you're Australian, the best mantra is breathing in, shut, breathing out, up. Shut, up. Shut, up. Now do that. It actually works. Simply, you say that to yourself enough times, you get the message. And okay, I'm going to shut up. So yeah, mantras, they do work. And it's not really interfering, because you're already interfering to begin with. It's like, you know, less interfering. So it's like fighting a fire with a backbone. 4 years ago, my wife went through menopause, and since then we have had not sex. Will I be breaking a precept if I have sex outside of marriage? Yeah, it's a real question. I'm just going to, because you all had an application form, I'm going to check the handwriting. I can check the handwriting with the application forms. No, I don't do things like that. No, it's all questions are sort of, they should be respected. And it's a great one. If she doesn't have sex, are you breaking a precept if you have sex outside marriage? And when... I'm getting giggles. It's an interesting question. In the first year I was a monk, one of the chief supporters of our new monastery at Wat Nanachat was the local headmaster of a school. Now, if you got to be a headmaster of a school in those days, you know, you were, you know, almost as respected as the monks. You were just such a senior person in the community. And this guy, you know, is Headmaster Shu. Every week he would go into town to the local brothel. And everybody knew him. And he had no compunction of going into the brothel to get some sex. And then we were shocked. And he said, is this a good thing for you to do? He's a chief supporter of our monastery. I think he was a treasurer. And he said, no, he'd asked Ajahn Chah. Because his wife, she had brain damage. And this man was looking after her just so caringly. But, you know, she couldn't even clean up the house or cook his food. He had to do everything for her, as well as his job as a school teacher. He was such a caring, kind man to his wife. And he said, look, I'm married, but my wife can't do anything. And, you know, I'm a man. I'm not sort of enlightened. You know, I have my needs. But my wife can't sort of supply them because of her brain damage. So he said, I went to see Ajahn Chah, and he said, in situations like that, you're not breaking your precepts. And that was actually sort of interesting, sort of, you know, how Ajahn Chah answered that question. So, I mean, your wife having menopause, it's not quite brain damage, but maybe that comes from a man. But you know what you mean, and sometimes that... You can see there's a valid argument there, but yeah, I don't know, because you have to sort that out with your wife. So I think really, you know, if she's gone through menopause, you know, maybe ask her, what did she think about it? Because these are things which are on the edge. I mean, are you really harming somebody? So that's a very good question. It's a good ethical question. Now, my advice would be, now you'd want more information, and just ask your wife, what does she think about it? But, you know, sometimes it creates a lot of problems. So it's much nicer, instead of actually, if your wife has gone through menopause, you haven't had sex, just get into jhanas, and then it solves all the problems. You don't need sex, you've got bliss better than sex. Who wants sex? Dear Ajahn, it's nice when you talk about there's nothing to do, nowhere to go, because there's no one in here. It's liberating and relaxing. Please talk more like that when the opportunity is right. Yeah, it's just this whole, like I already mentioned to you, this idea of choice and will. And that's one of the reasons why I talk about letting go, not doing anything. Because what I'm doing is actually I'm reconditioning you just to be still. All this doing, 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 you really think it's you in charge. You're not in charge at all. This thing which you take to be will and choice, that's one of the great illusions. And when you realize it's not you doing things, you feel totally free. You can't let go of the past. It's none of my business. I didn't do anything. Just the whole process led me up to that. Can you do that, let go? You let go of the present, because you don't have to do things. A lot of times we do things because it's acknowledging this illusion of a self. Because when you don't do things, it's like you disappear. It's like you're not there anymore. That's one of the great fears of meditation. The deeper you go, the less you can recognize of yourself. And you go really deep, and there's nothing there which you can put a finger on which is you. Especially the will is gone. And that's the part of you which you cherish so much that you refuse to let go. Because letting go of doing things is letting go of your ego. That's a tough one. And the only way it works is that because when you let go of your ego, when you stop doing things, it actually feels good. It's the peace, the joy, the bliss is actually the carrot which keeps you going deeper and deeper into disappearing. It's not just your body disappears, you disappear. And it's highly recommended from the top, from the Buddha himself, disappear is the highest happiness, Nibbana. So in this meditation retreat, just see if you can disappear. Ajahn Chah would always used to say the first year to everybody, have you come here to die? And it wasn't a guy with an Australian accent, you know, come here today. He was actually really meaning to die. And then what did you mean? No, sort of, I'm young, I was only 23 when I went up there first of all. What do you mean coming to die? You know, I want to live. I'm young too. You don't die at 23. But obviously he really meant sort of, you know, the ego dying, the self disappearing and vanishing. That's what you're here for, he said. Just to totally disappear and vanish. It's a wonderful teaching. So don't be afraid of vanishing in meditation. When you vanish, there's no one here to do anything anyway. And everything gets so still and peaceful. You find that you were the problem, or rather the illusion of you. So there is no one here. There's no one here. What are you doing? What do you mean you're meditating? How crazy can you be? Who's there to meditate anyway? And what are you trying to get anyway? So what we're trying to do is just to let go of things. Not to gain more experiences, but just to vanish. Vanish, disappear, until everything dissolves away, until nothing is left. Beautiful. So have you come on this meditation retreat to die? Vanish. So when you're going to die, die properly so don't get reborn again. If daily life sucks, shall we all leave our families and jobs and become monks and nuns? Yes! At last someone has understood. Well, actually, no, seriously, why not? How many lay people have we got in this world? Too many. We need more monks and nuns. Look, why? I think it's this week or is it next week, they have the Global Climate Change Conference in Copenhagen. And look, what's the real problem there? It's not the sort of the carbon emissions, it's just too many human beings, too many people. So how can we lessen the population of this world? More monks, more nuns. At least the Sangha in front of you here, we're doing our bit to lessen the population. By being a monk or a nun which don't have babies, we actually reducing our carbon. We should actually get, carbon credits, yeah. Every monk or nun should have 1,000 carbon credits because we don't have kids. Imagine that, those kids, and those kids have more kids, and those kids have more kids. Imagine how much carbon just, one life puts into that atmosphere. And how many resources, are consumed from the planet Earth. So as soon as we have a monk, the whole progeny is stopped there and then. No nuns. Great. So no, being more nuns, you're actually doing something wonderful for the planet. Now you're being sort of an ecological warrior. So it's great. More monks and more nuns. You've got 600 acres up in Dharamsala. And they're only taking up a tiny portion of that, so there's lots of space. Don't get worried, Ajahn Wayama. I know they won't even take us off on this. I tried this a long time ago, but they won't do it. Next question. Some mornings I wake up at 3 a.m. Should I meditate in my cottage till 4 a.m, then continue in meditation? Or you can meditate in your cottage or meditate anywhere. This whole place is yours for free. You can meditate in the toilet if you wish. So, if you wake up at the serious part of that question, if you wake up in the morning just and you feel, you've got energy, you're alive, just meditate. And if you make a mistake, you got up too early, you got up at 2 o'clock and you realise that, no, that was a mistake, you can go to bed afterwards, go to bed at 4. You don't have to listen to the chanting. The chanting is the same every morning and evening, and you can do the next day's chanting, it's okay. And even if you miss the talks, they're all recorded. So, and especially some of you have heard these talks, so many, many times. And some people on this retreat have been, quite a few retreats. So, you know all the jokes, all the stories and similes, so just go and meditate in your room. So it's okay to get up whenever you like and go to bed whenever you like. So you can actually experiment. So sometimes, you're meditating 10, 11, 12, you feel good. 12. And the trouble is, if you had to get up at 3 o'clock, it's 12 o'clock, you really feel good. You think, I better go to bed because I've got to get up at 3. And that's terrible when that happens. You don't have to get up at any time. So 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock, you're having a good time. Carry on. And you can catch up with the sleep tomorrow. You have all this time when you can go into your bedroom and just sleep whenever you want. So if the evening or night time or 1 o'clock, you're really hot meditating, go for it. You can catch up tomorrow. And you can do that here if you want, if you'd like meditating here, or meditating on the stupas, or meditating on the grass, or meditating in your room, wherever you want to meditate. The place is yours. Can a person purify one's mind, eradicate defilements, and gain final liberation without having to go through difficult training ground like being in a forest? Is it true that we need difficult conditions in order for us to access our deeper defilements before we can purify them? No, you don't. That's why we've got a nice retreat center, why you've got mattresses on the bed. If I really believed that, you need to go through a difficult training ground, I would have I just have concrete in your rooms. No pillows, no blankets, and just let you sort of sleep on the bare concrete with nothing on your head. And no blankets at all. And when you come up here, there will be a meditation mat made out of broken glass or spikes in it. Some people do that. That's part of, that medieval fanatical Christian, the ascetics, where they would whip themselves or they would wear these belts with... Actually, I saw that. There was in West Australia, and they were in a Catholic cathedral. They were doing some excavations and they found one of these crosses of one of the bishops about 100, 150 years ago and had spikes on it. So he'd wear this and it was always, you know, piercing his skin all the time. And that was actually morbid, that was weird. And but people thought that was the way to liberation. There was a Buddha who said, no, middle way. You don't have to go through difficult training ground. And if you've ever been on pilgrimage to India to see where the Buddha practiced, you know, like Bodh Gaya, it's just this beautiful park next to the river. It was actually prime real estate. Or, you know, up in the Jetavana monastery, this beautiful garden, almost like a king's park. Those are the sorts of places where the Buddha would meditate. Peaceful, cool, under the shade of trees, water nearby. In fact, many of the monasteries, they started off as they called them Aramas. And even these days, you know, Aramas, you know what the Sanskrit form of that is? Ashram. And Aram was like a place of pleasure. That's what it means in Pali. It was a place where rich people would have their little parks outside of the city. They could relax under the, you usually have mango trees, lots of fruits, the pleasure parks it was called. In the same way that I remember London, you know, people had their big houses and the big parks. And you've got things like Hyde Park, that used to be part of Kensington Palace. And St. James's Park, I think that was part of what, well, not Buckingham Palace, it was another palace, that's St. James's Palace, that's right. And all those parks, you know, they're taken over by the people. But they used to be the pleasure parks of the wealthy. And in India, people with the pleasure parks, they'd give it to the Sangha and they'd build monasteries there. But it was very comfortable places. And this is actually why people used to get enlightened in those days. So they weren't supposed to be harsh, comfortable. So that is actually the way to get enlightened. If it's too tough, people don't get enlightened. They get malaria. When I am peaceful, the room seems noisy. Yet when my mind is unsettled, the room seems still. Is this just another trick of the mind to keep me in an ego state? Well, it's obvious that when you're peaceful, there's nothing going on in your head, so you listen to the noises outside. But when you're sort of, your head is noisy, then it's more noisy than outside, so everything else seems still. So remember, when you let go of the noise inside, you become sensitive to the noise outside. That's all that really is. It's great not having a schedule. Ajahn Brahman, allowing the body to follow its nature. I notice instead of sleeping at night, I get sleep in the afternoon, evening, and I take three naps in between meditation instead of one long sleep at night. I have no choice, it's just what my body is doing. Meditation is easy that way. Yeah, that's great, that's how it works. So now listen to your body and be a friend to your body. The body will know when it wants to sleep and how much it wants to sleep. So don't think that you have to go according to a schedule. Even if you're meditating, some days you just want to sleep a lot. And you feel so good about it afterwards. And some days you don't feel like you need to sleep at all. And so sometimes I look at that, I don't know what my body's up to, or why it wants to sleep, or sometimes why it doesn't want to sleep at all. But I know, I trust my body enough, if that's what it wants to do, fine, off you go. So in the same way, I don't give you a schedule, I don't control you. Please don't control your body. Be a friend to your body, and your body will last a long, long time. When I'm at home and I wake up and try to do morning meditation, I'm often struggling to still the mind as I'm raring to go and so enthusiastic to start my day and my work. I feel lucky that I'm enthusiastic, but this often offers me a beautiful meditation. Please comment. Thank you. Someone really likes their work? You should tell your boss. And then they won't need to pay you so much. Because you know what pay is? Your salary is a bribe to make you do something you'd rather not do. If you really like doing your work, what's the point of paying you? You go anyway. Doesn't that make sense? Doesn't. I thought it was a good argument. Never mind. But anyway, even if you're enjoying, can't wait to get to work, just remember, that be in the moment. The work will come sooner or later. Your job is to enjoy this moment and don't keep planning for the future. Remember one of my favorite sayings, never do today what you can put off until tomorrow, because you might die tonight. Doesn't that make sense? I'd say it again, never do today what you can put off until tomorrow, because you might die tonight. One of these nights you're going to die. And that night which you die, you really regret that you didn't enjoy today because you were just preparing for tomorrow, which, you know, you were dead. So that's a great saying, because in our Western world, we always want to get things out of the way. You know, get things all done, and we're just missing life. So if you really want to go to work, you know, work doesn't start for another hour yet. And you might not even get to work. You might have a head-on car crash on the way to work and all that sort of trying to get there. You never reach there. So it's much better just to be in the moment. So when I wake up in the morning, I'm not an abbot until I go out and see the monks. So I enjoy myself. Okay, afterwards I go to work. But right now, they're not paying me yet. If they're not paying me, I'm not even going to think about work. Otherwise, you know, they're getting more work out of me than they're paying me for. I'm only going to work when I get to the office and get through that door. When the time they start paying me, that's the time I start thinking about work. Make sense? Anyway, last question coming up. Ajahn, please advise how to contemplate letting go. Don't contemplate letting go. Let go of contemplating. It's such a hard thing to do, isn't it? To let go of things. This monk I remember once. One of these stupid stories. He was having his lunch and he had his bowl of food in front of him. And I saw him push the bowl away. And then he pulled it towards him again. And he pushed it away again. And he pulled it. It was like yo-yoing backwards and forwards. What the heck are you doing? And he said, well, I was looking at my food and I realized I'm getting attached to that. So I let it go. I pushed it away. But then I thought, no, that's just being proud and conceited. So I pulled it towards me. He said, no, that's just attachment. Let it go. I said, no, I must do my duty. Pull it forward. He was thinking too much. So yes, if you're going to eat, eat. If you're going to sort of renounce, just renounce. And get it over and done with instead of just changing your mind every second. So if you're going to let go, just let go. Easy. You start thinking, I let go. How do I let go? What am I going to let go of? And you're just thinking too much. So that way, after a while you get the sense of how to let go. That's why we have this gradual training. You let go stage by stage. You let go of time to get in the present moment. You let go of speech to be silent. You let go of most of your body to be in the breath. Eventually you let go of the breath to get into the nimitta. You let go of the nimitta to get in the mind. You let go of will to go deeper. You let go of conscious, everything just vanishes. The main thing you're letting go of is control. Be free. Don't control. Sometimes, you know, you really like having no schedule here. Well, I don't control you. I don't tell you when you're going to come, when you're going to go, when you have to sit, when you have to do things. So we try not to control you. That's why we have no schedule, but it's also teaching you, don't control yourself. Be free, be at ease, be kind. If you don't control your body, you just sit here and just relax the body, and just you're sitting here because you're comfortable, then maybe you might not control your mind. If you're thinking, you're thinking. If you're tired, you're tired, because you don't control things. All those defilements, they just fade away. They totally disappear. Just let go. Make sense? Hopefully. Because that's all you're getting. Because it's now 9 o'clock and the end of another evening and the beginning of another night. So, how do you feel? If you've got energy, You feel like, yes, my mind, it wants to meditate. Ask your mind, ask your body. Body, how are you going? Do you want to go to bed or do you want to meditate? Or do you want to go and have a walk? Or have a cup of tea? Listen to your body. Listen to your mind. Mind, what do you want to do? You want to do some meditation? Mind says, okay, then do some. Work with your mind, work with your body. And you'll have a wonderful time here. If you're tired, don't worry. You've got many more days left to go. So now don't think that you've got to get enlightened tonight. As I said, I think yesterday, if you get enlightened tonight, what the heck are you going to do for the next 6 days? So just take it easy. And remember the mantra for today, this is good enough. Okay, so enjoy the evening.